whenever we have had like team members who love their job, they create miracles. One of them created an AI film out of only AI products.
The only change they made to launch ChatGPT was with a little bit of reinforcement learning to make it a chat format rather than predict the next token format, right?
Hey everyone, welcome to this Matrix Moments podcast with Murph.ai. Murph is a synthetic speech company which has grown, I think, 7x in the last 12 months, which is incredible. And our customers have used it to generate over 12 million minutes of AI voiceovers. We are privileged to be partners with the team for a while now. So I'm excited to welcome Ankur and Sneha to the podcast.
Thanks, Tanay. Thanks for having us over. And yeah, excited to do this together.
So I think just for starters, right, Ankur, I'll start with you and Sneha will come to you after that. But Ankur, you've been sort of in and around this domain for a while. So I would love to start with the timing of it all, right? So maybe if you could spend a couple of minutes on your background, what you see happening and why you thought it was the perfect time to start a company.
Sure. Yeah, I think in my experience, research always sort of precedes commercialization. And it's more than true for AI as a space. And in my last stint at Goldman, I was actually pretty close to the space. I was familiar with the research breakthroughs that were happening. I was really pumped up with the 2017 Transformers paper that came out. And yeah, that was sort of the inspiration to start something in the space for us. And so I started looking at all the generative things that were happening, especially in the research domain. Nothing was coming out in the commercial space yet. And speech sort of struck me as a place where there was maximum ROI, so to say, to be sort of derived from this sort of research work. And it continued to be a very non-maneuverable modality, in my opinion, because, I mean, once you've recorded something, getting it to in a completely different shape or form, whether it be accent transfer, anything you want to do with that speech, is a really hard problem. Something that just cannot be done without AI, and it was really clear at that point to me that this is going to be disrupted in the next few years. So we are sort of like early to this generative AI boom at that point.
Yeah, got it. And maybe for the rest of the founders who are interested in this domain, since you mentioned modalities, right? And you had shared that your team was working on things like document parsing and other such projects. So where are things hitting maturity? Where is there still opportunity to go further? And just if you could share timing of it all, that would be brilliant.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so I think everything started from 2012 paper of from Goodfellow on GANs, and 2017 on Attention is All You Need was the next sort of seminal work in this space. And then very recently, the diffusion work that has sort of made advancements on top of GANs. So every 5 years, there's really a seminal paper coming out, which is transforming the research world at least. And then a couple of years down the line, everything changes in the commercial world as well. And to your sort of question on what modalities would be impacted, I mean, I think speech synthesis definitely is being impacted by some of these. Image and video, again, a lot of people are very excited about it, but it's a space that's still evolving, especially from a commercial front. We're seeing a lot of promise from a lot of generative companies in speech and video domain. But again, the complexity increases when the possible outcomes are a lot. And in especially in case of video, it's just almost infinite possible outcomes. If you're trying to go from speech, from a text modality to a video modality, the number of outcomes that you can imagine is a lot. And that's really proportional to how complex that is. And that is sort of inversely proportional to how mature that tech has become so far. So the next wave is going to be in some of these complex modalities, that's for sure.
Got it. Thank you. And I think it's actually the combination for me that makes it far more interesting. So Sneha, once again, welcome to the show. I'd love to maybe spend a few minutes on your background as well as again, when Ankur talks about speech, what were your first reactions, right?
Right. So I have sort of always been curious about building new things. I have been in startups for over a decade now and was certainly looking to do something new. From my time, you know, when I was doing my marketing stint at Urban Ladder, I was sort of working very closely with creators. We used to build ads of, you know, all kinds. And I had seen sort of the challenges with, you know, voiceover and audio maneuverability pretty much like firsthand. When I remember the first time that Uncle created something and he showed me the output and I said, yeah, you know, this is really going to disrupt. We should do this because I just felt confident from having, you know, seen that space that, yeah, we would be able to sell this. You know, it was that moment for me. I think that was sort of like the start. But of course, like we discovered several other use cases along the way. But that's what sort of like helped me build real conviction, you know, about the idea.
Got it. So you obviously relate as a marketer and I've been a marketer myself, right? So you create a voiceover, it doesn't add up with the video. Maybe the pacing is wrong. Maybe you want to delete a word here and there. A lot of back and forth involved with the voiceover artist to get to the final output, right? And this really compresses that into minutes versus weeks, right? So I think that's brilliant. Seen the pain myself. You found an idea, obviously perfect timing. You said, let's go and sell this, right? So what happened next? How did you go about finding your first customers?
Right. So I think it's interesting, you know, even before like the beta product of Murph was out, we wanted to get validation from, you know, customers who sort of actually need that product, actually need the output, forget the product for a bit. So at that point, it was really about establishing the quality of the voiceover that we're able to create and whether that really like fits the bill in the minds of customers. And, you know, having been in the startup space, I did run it by a few people I knew in the marketing domain, in the creative domain. But I think a little bit from a conviction standpoint, like for the founding team, we said that, hey, you know, we want to really sell to customers who have not heard about us, don't know us. Probably will be super harsh with us about the feedback, but we want to do that, right? So, yeah, so that was sort of like the thought starter behind selling very early on and seeing if there is somebody in the world who finds value and you know, has no bias for us, right? So me and my, you know, co-founder Divyanshu, we sort of, you know, started reaching out to people on voiceover platforms, you know, platforms where customers would come looking for voice actors. So that was the bar that we kind of set for them, set for ourselves. And we would reach out to customers, you know, looking for this and say, hey, you know, we have this new AI-based product that we're building and this is the quality that we're able to achieve. Would you want to give this a try? And a lot of customers, were like, no, I'm not looking for AI voiceover, etc.
So just pausing on this one, right? So when you said platform or marketplaces where people come, what would these be? Because I've usually seen like voices and all where people are listing themselves, right?
So Upwork was one such platform where we sort of created an account and started reaching out. We were a new vendor even on Upwork. So it was, I mean, that was never the GTM. It was just an idea to test if the quality of the product really like stands for the customer. We also created an account on Fiverr and interestingly started getting orders, you know, like more inbound. And I remember that time that we did it like on a very small scale and eventually like sort of very quickly grew out of it. But it was very, very important for us to establish that, you know, at a global scale, with geographies we are not familiar with customer demographics that we're not familiar with, Can we still make that call and say that, hey, this is still like adding value. This is something that they want to buy. A lot of those customers, interestingly, ended up buying the subscription when we actually launched the product. That was sort of like the start, very early days. But I think another thing that I'll add to what I think Ankur was sharing about the market being super nascent at that time for at least realistic synthetic speech. But we had seen certain like pockets of the market, which we were small at that time, but they were growing like 10x over 6 months. And while that absolute scale was not enough, it would like give me confidence that this still continues to grow. And, you know, with the advancements that we were making on the R&D side, when this does become a mature market, it will be very, very big. So, I think that was sort of the thought behind investing on content very, very early on and being super consistent. Content is like one of those games where you see no ROI for like a really, really long time. You have to keep at it. I remember like the Murph blog and the website, and there was pretty much just me, Ankur, and DP for almost like a little short of a year. And I used to write everything like myself. And yeah, that's how we sort of started with little things and scaled that eventually.
Yeah. So phenomenal tech, obviously, right? I think, again, instruction for all founders, do things that don't scale. Find customers who give you brutal feedback, hopefully not from the network, otherwise they say good things, right? But when you had to think about, again, building a motion and a product that could scale, right? How did you make those choices around the go-to-market, right? Because you've created a voice, now there's a lot of different places where this can be applied, right? So what were some of the choices over there?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So for us, there were two things that sort of led us to go PLG overall. The first thing was that we wanted to be a global company right from the get-go. We knew that the market for synthetic speech was, well, for whatever reason, it was the largest in US, Canada. It was where all the incumbents already had presence. So we wanted to compete at that scale. We didn't want to fall short of that. So that was one sort of thought. The second thing was that we very quickly realized that the way the initial like shape and form of that our product did take, it wasn't very hard to understand value in the product if you have the use case. If you don't have the use case, you probably would like play around and see, hey, maybe someday. But if you are looking for a voiceover, and it works, then it just works. So I think these were sort of like the two considerations that led us to go fairly with a like very simple self-serve motion. And just scale. We realized that once, we were able to get ourselves, our product in front of the relevant audiences, they would try out the product and a lot of them would buy. And we said, hey, if this is working, could we just work on getting ourselves in front of, a larger audience, which has a similar use case. I think that criteria still did apply. And that's where I think a bunch of our, overall content strategy, inbound, intent-based marketing, all of that was focused, because I think in the early, at least year and a half, we did not at all, venture to a brand marketing or that kind of zone. We really said that if customers have a use case, can we serve them well? Are they finding value, right? And we sort of like really scaled. I think that overall effort did pay off a lot, last like 6-8 months when this became really big. So in hindsight, I think it was a good choice of strategy that we did. Yeah.
So your observations were A, fast time to value, and B, probably that people are already looking for solutions and you don't have to sort of evangelize and create demand, right? And sort of both of them added together. And maybe one curious byline, but given that ChatGPT was probably the marketing moment for all things Gen AI, what have you observed in your domain since that time?
Yeah, I mean, we have nothing in our business. Honestly, like our business does not relate to ChatGPT directly in any way that I can imagine. Yeah. But I think just the general curiosity around AI and what it can do really exploded the awareness that, creators had or started having about what's possible. And even if they were not aware, they wanted to get aware. And what that led to, that even for audio space, there are like segments where we've seen like 10x growth over just a span of like 4-5 months. That was, I think even in my experience, I think it was quite a moment to experience, as a marketer as well. Yeah. And it's certainly very, very interesting times to be in the space.
Yeah. And I know I've spoken to you about this before, right? But building a US first B2B GTM is hard, right? Because the toolkit is finite, right? You can buy a billboard, do an event, run a podcast, write content online, run some ads, hire some outbound sales reps, right? So I think finite set of options, and then it becomes, for me at least, a game of execution, right? That what can you do really well and where can you stand out, right? And if we've not understood this already, you are really crafty in how you get to customers. So when you thought about that, okay, there is demand online, I need to sort of get in front of this audience, what were the 2-3 things that you did that stood out in terms of driving demand for the product organically? And maybe, again, the devil is in all the details, so the more you can share, the better.
Sure. I think the first thing that I'll say about generating any kind of organic traffic, irrespective of what channel you're after, is about consistency and quality of content. What you say does matter. If you say things that are just irrelevant or is just like really low quality. So I remember that until like a year ago, I used to review every single piece of content. And after that, I just started realizing that, hey, I'm being probably a control freak about this and stop doing it. I don't do it anymore. But for a really long time, I was very worried about the kind of content that we're putting out. And at least I kept sort of our, conscience clean on that we would not put out something that we don't like. Yeah. A lot of it was written in-house, really with hard work, right? Quality. The second thing about it is actually consistency. And I think like I was mentioning earlier, for a lot of channels, you just have to keep doing it. And for a really long time, you see like very, very incremental movement. But then when that step shift happens, it's like bigger than like any channel that can like create for you. So we stayed consistent. And I think somehow our early team members did carry that philosophy forward really, really well. They sort of like stayed at it, kept creating, content on relevant topics. We did not spread ourselves thin. And the reason for that was that we knew that there was sort of like deep intent in certain categories versus some other, businesses where you would take a very sort of wide approach.
So I'll actually double click on that, right? So text to speech, very broad category. Is that what you went after?
That is one of the categories that we did go after. But there were a lot of like new market creation sort of possibilities coming up as well. But then again, we stayed within the domain of voice. We did not just want to generally, we could have, created content on all kinds of generative media. Some of it we are venturing into now because of, our product offering increasing. But I always feel, like any decision that I take for GTM is always customer backed. And I feel that if I'm, putting in that effort for the team to sort of, create content and then for that customer to discover us and land on the site and we don't have something to offer, it's just like it's just a waste for everybody, right? So we don't create like content about like everything in the world, but on the topics that we do create, we go very, very deep. We sort of explore all use cases and, really stay consistent about it. I think it's just consistency and hard work, I would say, quality. That was like one whole piece in that sense. I think apart from that, one large piece that we continue to work on is improving the product experience because it's only half the job done to get people in. If they, our motion is completely self-serve for a very large part of our audiences. And if they are not able to discover what we create and just are not successful at creating whatever they are here to create, they are not going to buy us. So yeah, I think just the pace of like product feature launches, I think Ankur has this philosophy of just, just ship fast. This express shipping psychology in the org that I think his entire team has, I think you can touch upon more on that. But we just kept hearing from customers and building and building and building and building, right? And a lot of the features that we built in the early years, honestly, I think we had not visualized that the product will have these. They only came up when we spoke to customers and they said, hey, you're doing great at this, but can't you just simplify my workflow by doing this? Or can't you add this feature? I want to maneuver the voice in a certain way. I want my brand to sound a certain way. Things like that, right? Use cases like the voice changer. I think it was completely visualized out of customer use case that I have already created so many videos and I just need to change my voice. Like, why are you asking me to create a script again? So we said, hey, just bring in your video or your audio. We're going to do the rest, right? So, yeah.
It just goes back to build something that people really want philosophy. Everything we built from our initial launch days to now, so far has been all customer demands.
Yeah.
Just tracking them. Because we have a very high volume inbound motion. We have enough statistics to know who's going to be willing to pay for what and what kind of audience needs what. And as far as that aligns with our general direction in terms of who we are trying to cater to, it's really easy to build a roadmap out of that.
And I know you mentioned that you stopped looking at content, team is taking the mandate forward. I'll come to the team in a minute. But I want to talk about the listicles, because when I was doing the research, you were on top or at sort of close to the top of every listicle that I went to, and Google sort of prioritizes them now. So how did you make that happen?
Yeah, I think a lot of that credit does not go to me. It goes to my co-founder, Divyanshu, again. I think very early on, what we started doing is that he would like reach out to influencers in the community who were sort of like thought leaders in you know, innovative tech products, and just ask them to check out our product and share a review if possible. When we were very, very small, nobody knew about us. A lot of them wouldn't put in the effort to check us out, but some did, thankfully. And we kept consistent about that as well, just like with anything organic. And yeah, over time, one influencer posted and another one heard from them. And that sort of like started snowballing after a point. But there was this interesting story that I remember, you know, about DP reaching out to one of, I mean, I wouldn't name them, but they are very, very, you know, very large tech blog, and they only review products that they think are innovative. They wouldn't even open our product, you know, to just consider us for a very long time. But then he kept at it for 2 long years until the guy decided to sort of...
From an anonymous email ID. So they think,
yeah. I mean,
what was that email that he sent?
No, so he just, I think we just said that, you know, the blog is outdated, which it was.
So you, were you like a customer saying this blog is outdated, I saw this cool product you don't have?
I wouldn't say we were a customer, because, you know, for a blogger, it's a reader, and they care about their readers. And yeah, I think... this was one of them where, like, the blog was not updated actually for a very long time. Somehow, the person had not considered to see what new is coming up in the space. And yeah, thankfully, he did after 2 years, and we did manage to sort of rank there as well. Yeah.
Awesome. And I know we've spoken a little bit about kind of customers already, right? But you are giving them a voice, and they can do anything with it, right? So I'm curious to know, like, what are some interesting stories or wacky ideas that customers came up with, and also sort of surprised you, right? And I know it's an important factor because they drive a lot of the roadmap. So curious to hear what you saw.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a diverse set of use cases. You know, business customers, like, you know, there's someone who's been using us for over 2 years. They have their own entire, you know, LMS system, and yeah, they found us early on. They were using well, one of the clouds before us, and they, well, we are way more expensive than them, but they found the realism in the voices really valuable for their customers in turn, and they have been using us for like a very long time for creating all sorts of content. Well, on the wacky side, well, like, we've had very interesting customers. One of them created an AI film out of only AI products. As a pretty famous person, I wouldn't name them, but yeah, they used our voices for it. They used another tool for generating the script. They used another tool for generating the video. We've seen podcasters create entire podcasts out of Morph voices.
So I've
seen ads. No, I think it's lovely to see. I think some of the changes that are, you know, creators. I think I had actually read this somewhere a few years ago that with the creator economy, as soon as the power is handed in the, you know, hands of the creator to do something new, they do things that surprise the builders all the time, right? And we've seen that stuff happening all around. You know, with ads, with you know, just you know, like I said, podcasters,
people creating poems. You've had people doing jazz. It's not important.
Yeah, even raps. Somebody sent us like a whole rap that they created. Yeah, we didn't have like all these use cases in mind when we created it, but yeah, it's just the power of that economy, I guess.
Awesome. And I know, so I wanted to talk about, you mentioned shipping philosophy, you mentioned team, right? And I think one thing that struck me when I walked into your office was that it was just quiet, right? Like everyone was heads down working. Our office is much more noisier than that. So what's the philosophy around, and I think also not meant to be as a compliment, but I think the number of people you have and the velocity at which you ship and the scale you build is actually phenomenal, right? So what's the philosophy around shipping product as well as around hiring people?
Sure. The shipping philosophy, maybe you can cover better. It mostly comes from Ankur.
Yeah, I mean it's a known thing, right? I mean, we want, in general, what I tell all my devs is, we don't know if it's going to succeed, right? So what would you rather do? Spend a quarter on it and then say it failed, or build it in a week and then let's see how it behaves and then iterate further to see whether we're going to pursue it or we're going to dump it or we're going to make it really awesome. So it's really like fail fast, in my opinion, which makes or breaks startups. And that's really what defines a startup. I mean, I might as well otherwise behave like corporates, right? So we iterated a lot, and because also some of the times we may be wrong with our prioritization, we may be wrong about what we pick directionally, or maybe sometimes even in understanding what the customer wanted. A lot of times customers are also not very, they're not very crisp about what they really want, right? There might be a mismatch in our understanding and their expectations. And all of this, end of the day, can only be sorted out if you give something in their hands, get their perspective, and then build on it. All the sprints, it's a mandate right now for us to keep it shorter than 2 weeks. We don't want to go beyond that. Exceptionally, we might sometimes for really complicated, but that's very different for research, of course, where the projects run really long. But devs, we really try to build small things, deliver every week, 2 week sort of a time scale, has helped us a lot in picking the right directions and building on things that are working for us. So that's really our mantra, to figure out what should we be doing. Because as I said, I mean, the inbound motion sort of helps this kind of a technique. If you were building for a few corporates, then you have someone to talk to. But this is really statistical things that we're doing. So you need to experiment a lot more.
No, I think that's interesting, because at least for us, we've seen companies at the other end of the spectrum who are building for 12 months, 15 months before they even come to market. But it's probably more nuanced even for the category, right? Because in a domain where people also don't know what to expect, what are the possibilities, what they really want, you really need to show them something and get reactions versus sort of build in stealth for longer, right? So to speak.
Yeah.
We were selling 2 months from the day we started building this. So that was a proof. We didn't want to give out things for free for a long time just because it doesn't prove anything. So we kept the price point low, but we still want to charge to see if they really want it, they really need it, or it's just not being serious about it. So that was the philosophy throughout.
Let's talk about the hiring philosophy.
Hiring, I think we sort of keep the bar high. We almost never overhire. We look for passion for the job when we recruit for any role. It doesn't actually just apply to research or dev, it applies to every single member of the team. If they don't love what they do, at least we believe that, you're probably better off doing something else because it's just a drag to sort of, I think. And we've seen this over and over again. Whenever we have had team members who love their job, they create miracles, every single time. That one person is always, always valuable to the team. And we try and sort of look at that. In general, I think as a team, we have almost no hierarchy. Everybody's has ownership of something that they're doing. And we trust them, after we recruit them, we don't doubt them on their skills or ownership. We believe that, we hire very good people. We have been fortunate to have some really great team members, in the team carrying the org. But yeah, it's just that I think like not doing unnecessary alignment meetings wherever it's not required, and everybody sort of knows what they need to know in general as a culture. It's not expected that somebody will come and tell me something and that is when I get to know about developments happening. So yeah, I think generally we keep it like super flat, you know, few people owning big pieces, having fun while they, whatever, you know, they are doing. And I think that's large part of, yeah. I think something about the office that you mentioned also goes back to like the kind of work a large part of the team is doing. Whether it is, you know, the research team or even the business teams, in our domain, like a lot of them are working on hard problems. We cannot deny that, right? And it needs that focused, deep work to happen for any sort of monumental outcome to come out, right? And I guess like we try our best to create that sort of environment that's conducive to that kind of deep work. There is like no clear mandate. You can scream in the office as well. It's all right. It just happens to be that they are probably onto something. And that's what probably keeps the office quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I think, Ankur, coming back to you, I think, and going back to technology, right? So I'm curious to know, in this domain of synthetic speech, what are the tech breakthroughs that you expect in the coming years, or the things that you are excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think synthetic speech, so I think it's been fairly advanced. Last few years have been already been very exciting. People are largely convinced now that communication as a sub-aspect of it is fairly solved. But art is something that still needs some sort of breakthroughs for this to get used. It's almost like how a voice coach would coach a voice actor. That kind of maneuverability is what I expect to be there in our offerings in the near future. In fact, the idea is you being able to completely direct the outcomes of AI. So far, all our tooling has been browser-based. You're trying to deal with some sort of UI or some sort of an interface. But I think the next generation of tools that will build on synthesis are going to be where you are interacting much more naturally. You would be very explicit in terms of how something should be done. You'd probably not depend on a UI to direct that, because probably that's not a very natural sort of thing to do, because there are a lot of nuances. So you may want to have very specific requirements on, you may have very specific requirements on your pronunciation changes. You may have specific nuances on accents that you want within a sentence. You might want to change the emotion. So there's just so much you can do when you get into the art side of things, and I think I'm very confident that in the near future that all of that is going to actually be catered to. Other field I feel which is going to be disrupted is the low resource language spaces. So far, I mean, English, obviously there's abundance of resources around building stuff on top of those languages, but a key aspect of low resource work is the ability to transfer that knowledge into that language. Or similar things could be said for accents as well. You might learn in a certain accent, certain language, but be able to transfer that knowledge, that emotion, that accent, that maybe pace. So any of those aspects, being able to decouple and then put it back into a different packaging, because ultimately you will not have access to every single resource in every single language, in every accent, every possible variability out there for your model to learn from. So that ability to do this kind of transfers, we're already seeing good sort of breakthroughs in this space, and it should be close to commercialization fairly soon. So you'll be able to deal with any language eventually in the sort of similar agility that we can do today with English, and beyond as well, obviously.
No, but that's interesting. So I think on a spectrum, we are going from communication to acting, and sort of more emotions, more tuning, more sort of creativity.
Natural ways to tune it. Yes. Yes, that's coming.
Got it. And I know, favorite VC question, right? And maybe it's not a very good question, but all this brings me to data, right? So what role does data play in this, right? Is it a head start in the short term? Is it a moat in the longer term? And how do you think about it in the category?
So this answer actually varies if you are in, depending on what kind of AI you're trying to do. Within speech as well, the answer, in my opinion, varies. If you're trying to do ASR, speech to text, that is, or synthesis, the answer varies because if you were in the learning sort of a domain of AI, which is speech to text, typically you have one right answer. That's true for anything you're doing on an image as well. If you're doing image segmentation or object detection, any of that, right? But that's not true for synthetic media. That's not true for generative AI, and that's where the same text can be read in infinite number of ways. And what that means is data is going to define how the outcomes are, and that means there's huge possibilities in terms of what should we collect, and the convergence is nowhere near. That's one aspect. The other is the expectation from synthesis is that you're going to produce pristine outputs. We are looking for something that's going to compete with what a voice actor can do today. So from that perspective, again, synthesis is a space where clean data is important. So again, becomes a moat to some degree. And the third aspect I feel is because we are synthesizing something which sounds like someone, there is that aspect of likeness, and we as a company have sort of very strict policies and on around ethics around voice cloning and how we sort of prevent that abuse, and that makes the data that we collect and we build, in fact, ourselves a big sort of part of our strategy, because it's not like you could or should just go out there and pick any voice and just start using that. So that's not an option for us. And from that perspective, again, I think in this space, it remains and will remain to be a moat, at least for the near future. Very long term, still hard to predict whether a lot of companies would have enough interest to build something that broad. But yeah, definitely a moat in the next few years, at least.
And I know you mentioned sort of the ethical and legal aspects to it, right? So I know, and you also mentioned voice cloning, right? So I'm sure customers ask you for this all the time. So what was your stance on it?
Yeah, we actually don't do any kind of self-service voice cloning today. We are vetting the person who's trying to use it for what purpose. We have voice fingerprinting to identify whether it's the same person who's given that recording. We have all the measures in place to know that it's being used in an ethical way. If we have enough consent from that person. As you said, yes, demand for it is there in terms of, and the laws aren't great yet, but we have we're already sort of ahead of that curve in terms of how to sort of be completely on the right side of this, and that's been our philosophy. We've not anything else on your mind in this?
I think we sort of have very, very clear, transparent contracts with the actors we work with, and we protect their data with all the might that we can. Yeah, and we don't let anybody clone something that doesn't belong to them or they don't have consent. Yeah, like Ankur said, we've been very clear on that from the start.
So I actually had an interesting experience on this one. I was trying one of these AI music generators, and I just created 4 tracks, played them out, opened Shazam on my phone, and Shazam could sort of link them back to at least 2 out of 4, it could detect what the music was, right? So even in music, like that sampling, it sort of mapped to another song. So I think the legal implications are very real, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Quite higher than text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know, so data was obviously one hot topic. The other one, I think, which everyone loves is defensibility, right? Whether you are a founder or an investor, it's top of mind for everyone because, you know, the pace of change is honestly anxiety-inducing. I tell people that I switch off Twitter just to save my mental bandwidth from this and to sleep well at night. But, In fact, a couple of founders even told me there might be a late mover advantage, that let's just sit out for 2 years, see where all the dust settles, where is the technology at, and we'll start building after that, right? So when you think about this, right, how do you build comfort that, you know, like at least in the short to midterm, that you'll be all right and you don't kind of get disrupted overnight?
Right? Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, that's true for any field. If you don't want to be disrupted, you need to be that person who disrupts the market. You need to be the thought leader. You need to sort of be ahead of others. And that's true for our space as well. We want to be the people who bring about that disruption, right? So the pace of it continues to be important. To the point of whether there is any advantage in being late to the game, from a research perspective, I agree to that. You don't want to be the first one to probably, go ahead and commercialize something that was written yesterday by someone. But from a GTM perspective, once like trying to commercialize it, I think I still feel being early has an advantage. There's a lot of discovery in the journey, both for the company and for the customers, as to what they can use this for and what we can build for them. And that's going to take a lot of time. And there's going to have a lot of nuances to it that you can only discover if you are early. We have been doing on that journey for 2 years now. We know what will work for whom. What is it that people really care about? There are subtle things about when we change something, we now exactly know what the customer is going to say about this change. And we could actually see a lot of people out there trying to build things where we were very intuitively able to say that this is going to pain their customers, right? So over a long term, the defense is going to come from understanding the customer, their needs, what and how they're going to use your product. That's the long term, definitely true. But in the short term, because the space is evolving so far, so fast, I mean, innovation in this space and being on top of research is going to be really key. So next couple of years is going to be key. Again, ultimately, once the dust settles, and it'll take longer to settle, especially in case of generative, because I said there's a lot of outcomes possible compared to the learning sort of space of AI. This is going to take much longer to settle down. But once it does, the moat is going to come actually out of knowing what your customer is using you for and building for their workflows. So that SaaS play is going to become important eventually, yes.
Got it. No, and I know just sort of in the domain of engineering and research, right? So we get a lot of slack saying, okay, ChatGPT happened and everyone woke up to this idea, but in the domain of research, everyone could see it coming 3-4 years out, right?
Yeah, I mean, the pace, like just between like GPT-3 and the initial version and 3.5, you could just see that pace of improvements, and people like to move the goalpost all the time of what AI can do and cannot do. And then literally, the only change they made to launch ChatGPT was with a little bit of reinforcement learning to make it a chat format rather than predict the next token format, right? Yeah. That's really just a change in how it's interacting. But from an understanding of the world perspective, there's not a lot of change. So 3.5 was around for 1 year before I think ChatGPT was launched. And Transform was 2017 paper. So it's like 5 years in the making. And the only thing truly that they claim being transformational about it is the size of the model. You just pick a transformer, put some reinforcement learning, and then you sort of grow with the size. And the mode becomes maybe the training cost. But of course, yes, researchers, we're seeing this happen for a long time. At least the technique isn't new or nothing that got created in the last 2 years. So yes, a lot of people saw it.
And I know you touched upon some of this already, right? But maybe if I go back to the world of, say, natural language understanding versus anything generative, right? I always use the example of Gong, right? But for me, it was a case of Gong started, right? But today that technology is available as an API. There's DeepGram and Assembly AI and a bunch of others. But they've built obviously an enterprise workflow targeting sales leaders, right? So they're doing call intelligence, then forecasting and bunch of other things, and they've built a massive brand, right? So in this sector, like, what do you see? What patterns will repeat? What will be different? And is it just kind of this traditional SaaS mode where you know, it's depth of workflow and some right to distribution, or is it something different?
Long term, as I said, I think I agree. Yes, it will become important. But that long term, as I said, is going to be much longer in generative space. That's the main difference between, so like getting a speech to text good for your specific domain, you could do that like 10 years back. And it was achieved fairly fast. But that was because there's just one true answer, as I said. I mean, this is a space where you want that kind of like, brand managers will say, this is the kind of voice that will fit my product. This is what will sell my product. They are that specific about when they pick out a voice actor, right? They would want that kind of choices with their AI voices as well. So there is a vast sort of array of things that will play out, and then people will ultimately settle on what are the best. There will be a curve around it. There will be very popular things, there will be less popular things, and there will be a full array of it. Just the diversity of outcomes is going to delay that process of settling down, and then just your GTM being your strategy or more, that phase will come. I can anticipate that, but it'll take longer.
Got it. Awesome. I think we spent enough time. So with that, we'll call it a wrap. Once again, congratulations on building a fantastic, fantastic business. And thanks so much for making time.
Thank you so much for having us and, you know, sharing our story, Pranay. Lovely talking to you.
Pleasure's ours.
Pleasure's ours. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.